It usually will take time to get the full story from the client because you have to go through that process to build trust. It would not bother me to discover that a client was guilty, or necessarily even surprise me to discover that a client was guilty. My role is not to defend innocent people. My role is to protect people's rights and to give them the best defense possible. And that's equally true for clients whose guilt I may be convinced of. It's also true for clients who dispute the charges against them.
Welcome to How I Lawyer, a podcast where I talk to attorneys from throughout the profession about what they do, why they do it, and how they do it well. I'm your host, Jonah Perlin, a law professor in Washington, D.C. Now let's get started. Hello and welcome back. In today's episode, I speak with Megan Siddle, who's currently the managing partner at the all-women litigation boutique that she co-founded, Minor Siddle, based in Boston, Massachusetts. Megan's practice focuses on white-collar criminal defense, but she also has extensive experience in civil litigation, government enforcement actions, and criminal appeals. Megan has experience in firms of all sizes, having practiced in big law in Washington, D.C., and for a medium-sized litigation boutique in Boston. Megan started her career as a law clerk to Judge John G. Codal of the Southern District of New York. On a personal note, Megan is one of the first associates I ever worked for and was an exceptional mentor to me as a junior lawyer, so it's really fun to get the chance to interview her. Megan's a graduate of Georgetown, go Hoyas, and Harvard Law, go Crimson. Welcome to the podcast, Megan.
Thanks for having me, Jonah.
So I want to start by asking you to talk just a little bit about what you do now.
I have a small criminal defense boutique with my partner, Tracy Miner, and my practice focuses primarily on white-collar criminal defense and criminal appeals. So I would say about 50% of my practice is white-collar and 50% is criminal appeals. All of my clients are people who've been accused of wrongdoing of some sort or another.
And so for someone who's unfamiliar with the concept of white-collar criminal defense, what makes that different than your everyday criminal defense work?
Sure. So it roughly refers to people who've been accused of financial or business-related crimes or healthcare-type fraud crimes. So it's not going to include drug crimes or violent crimes, typically.
And how do your clients come to you, or how do you get to them?
A variety of ways. Honestly, our single biggest referral source are former clients. And so people...
It's a good sign for the future of your work, right?
Yes, we do appreciate, especially when we hear from former clients. We also, both of us are on various panels with different courts. So my partner, Tracy, is on the CJA panel with the District of Massachusetts. I'm on the post-conviction panel in our state courts here in Massachusetts. And so we get a number of court appointments as well.
And what excited you about doing white-collar criminal defense?
When I was clerking, I was really struck by the criminal defense bar and by the criminal defense cases that I observed. The criminal defense lawyers that I was watching seemed to have the greatest job that I could imagine. They were in court all the time. They were standing up for clients who they knew and really got to believe in against a pretty powerful government. They tended to be somewhat contrarian, which resonated with me. And it just seemed like a job that I was extremely interested in doing.
And on a day-to-day basis, what kinds of things are you doing? I assume it's not going to court every single day, although I imagine there's a court component to it. What are the kinds of things that sort of fill your time?
Sure. One of the things I like about my practice the most is that there is really no day that's like any other. White collar tends to have a fairly high writing component. So between that and my appellate practice, there's a fair number of days where I'm locked up in my office and writing a brief or writing a significant motion. There are other days that we're in court for a trial or for other hearings, or we're meeting with government prosecutors for proffer sessions, and other days where we're spending significant amounts of time just meeting with our clients, getting up to speed on the facts and preparing our defense.
So it sounds like you have both sort of the fact development part of the law, but also the hard law piece of it. The what does the law say? What should the law say? Who does the law apply to? If you had to choose more fact development or more of that heady academic legal writing side, which would you choose?
That's one of the reasons I picked white collar, is I don't have to choose.
Amazing.
We really do end up, there's a huge fact development portion of the job, especially in white collar cases. We'll get discovery from the government that's terabytes of data. It's often lots of emails and documents. And so there's a huge component of the job where we're just piecing together what the story is, what happened, and what the government's going to be able to prove and where we might be able to poke holes in that case. But white collar is also substantively a very rapidly changing and interesting area of the law. And so there's a lot of legal brainiac brief writing that I get to do as well. And I like that I get to do both components.
Yeah. And I like to talk a little bit about sort of brass tacks, how this is all done. How do you deal with a new case that comes in the door, especially one where I imagine the government version of the facts and your client's version of the facts may not 100% line up? So how do you get up to speed? What kinds of things are you doing, or what kinds of things would you recommend to young lawyers who are just getting a new case in the door?
That's a great question, especially in white collar, because, or criminal defense in general, by the time the case arrives at my door, I am way behind where the government is, because the government may have been investigating for quite some time before my client even knew that they were under investigation. So I'm always playing a little bit of catch up. So the first thing we would do is meet with our client and spend as much time as we possibly can with them to try to learn their story, collect whatever documents they have available to them if the government hasn't already seized them. And then we would call the government and have a conversation with them about what's the investigation about, what can they share with us at this point in time. Once there's an indictment, at some point we are entitled to automatic discovery from the government. And that's when we can really dig into and find out what the government has.
My other question is something that you told me was one of the skills that you've really tried to work on and hone is showing empathy for your clients. And I guess, especially in that first meeting, how do you negotiate this new relationship with a client that needs to trust you right away, but also is accused? It's probably your client's either worst day of their life or close to it. How do you build that relationship from the beginning?
We would usually tell a client, we believe them. We want to hear their story. We are there for them, and we are there to fight for them. That is especially a challenge in cases where we've been appointed by the government, because we might be walking into a lockup cell and introducing ourselves to a client who has never heard of us, who didn't choose us. And we walk in and say, here I am, I'm your court-appointed lawyer. And all they know is that the court is the entity that's holding them. And they don't necessarily trust us on day one. And so the first thing we try to do is to show the client that we are there to fight for, answer all of their questions, take whatever time they need to answer all of their questions, try to speak with their family as soon as we can so that their family knows they can trust us, they can call us at any time. I often give my clients my cell phone number and say, call anytime, day or night, and I will pick up the phone anytime, day or night. And over time, you do gradually build that trust.
And is it hard? Also, I imagine not every criminal indictment has a grain of truth to it, but some do. Have you ever been in a situation where you've struggled because you feel either that the client's not telling you what you need to know or not telling you the truth, or maybe you think guilty from moment one? How do you deal with that?
Sure. It usually will take time to get the full story from the client because you have to go through that process to build trust. It would not bother me to discover that a client was guilty, or necessarily even surprise me to discover that a client was guilty. My role is not to defend innocent people. My role is to protect people's rights and to give them the best defense possible. And that's equally true for clients whose guilt I may be convinced of. It's also true for clients who dispute the charges against them.
And I guess the last question I tend to ask people about what they do is what their favorite part of their job is, and also what their least favorite part is. So how would you answer that?
My favorite part is the counseling aspect of the job, getting to know the clients. As you said earlier, when I meet them, it is often one of the worst days of their lives, and helping walk them through that process and help them get to the end of it is enormously gratifying for me. The least favorite part of the job is the reality that most criminal defendants lose. And there is just an emotional component of that, that as a criminal defense lawyer, you have to be prepared to absorb some of that stress that your clients are going through.
Does that get easier as you take on more cases, or is it always a challenge?
It gets harder, unfortunately.
Why do you say that?
because I'm finding as I go along in my career, I'm taking on more and more serious cases. And so my clients are facing more significant punishments down the road.
And was it hard? And then we'll transition to the difference between big law practice and small law practice. But was it hard to move from an environment where you were part of a very large team with a whole sort of host of people both above you and below you to being where the buck stops? Was there a moment where you walked into a client meeting and said, oh my goodness, I don't even know what I'm supposed to be doing here? Like, how did you get up to the speed quickly?
It actually wasn't as jarring a transition as you might expect, because as you'll remember from Williams and Connolly, there's a tradition there of throwing people into the deep end and giving people a substantive experience early on. So that wasn't quite brand new to me when I transitioned to a smaller firm. But it's certainly true that all of a sudden you find yourself in a situation and you're the only one who can get the job done or conduct the deposition or examine the witness. And nothing will focus you more than a deadline or a judge looking at you waiting for you to ask the next question.
That's true. That's absolutely true. Let's talk a little bit about the differences in your various sort of stops along your career. You were a big firm lawyer, then you went to a smaller firm in Boston, and now you're part of a firm that I think is two or three lawyers, perhaps. What are the differences in practicing in those environments?
Sure. Williams & Connolly is a big firm, but it's not as big as some of the traditional big law firms. Everyone was in the same office building. You did get to know the other lawyers pretty well. And I felt like we spent a lot of time on fairly small, tight-knit teams. Mm-hmm. And then when the case was over, you might move on to a different team and you might have other teams that you were working with at the same time. But that small team focus was very similar to what it's like to be at a smaller firm. It's just that at a small firm, that those team members never change.
Right. You're the only team at that point.
Yeah, you're the only team. So moving to a small firm wasn't as jarring as I thought it might be. The biggest difference was we didn't have the same resources. We didn't have the teams of document reviewers. We didn't have teams of paralegals. And I had to be a little bit more resourceful on my own. And moving from our prior boutique to where we currently are was effectively no change at all, because we'd actually been operating as the white collar group at our prior firm together. So we essentially kept the same personnel, and our workflow and our work styles all stayed the same.
And you say you had to be more resourceful. What does that mean in practice, to be more resourceful?
You mentioned, for example, how you handle discovery at a small firm. And that is much more challenging at a small firm, because you can't just call up another attorney and have 30 document reviewers show up.
Imagine that's a big difference.
Yes, that is definitely a significant difference. But we're also representing somewhat different clients. Most of our clients are individuals and not companies. And so the volume of documents for our clients is much smaller than it. Fortunately, Massachusetts has a local rule that requires the government to produce an index with their productions. And those indexes are usually pretty detailed. So that does a fair amount of the work for you in terms of sorting through and identifying the most important documents. But still, at the end of the day, you have to sit down and read the documents yourself, and you just have to budget more time to do that, because you don't have an army of people who can sort through it for you.
Sure, sure. And that's obviously one of the challenges. Are there things that are easier or better about the small firm or smaller firm practice?
Sure. I would say one of the significant improvements in a small firm is you have much more control over your time and your schedule. I just remember many instances in a big firm setting where you get a call from a partner at 4:30 p.m. on a Friday, and all of a sudden your weekend is gone. And you don't really have control over when that will or won't happen. In a smaller firm, we're a little bit more aware of what's going on in each other's cases, who's busy when, and we do our best to work around people's schedules and let everyone take weekends or nights when they need them, spend time with their family when they need to. I wouldn't say that the number of hours I'm working has gone down, but my ability to choose when those hours will occur has definitely improved.
And do you think there's a benefit for your clients as well?
Yes, I think there are several benefits for our clients. The most obvious one is our rates are significantly lower. The other highly underrated benefit is that they get our attention and only our attention. If you hire me, I'm going to be working the vast majority of your case.
And yeah, that's a huge benefit, I would imagine. One of the other big changes I noticed about your path is you changed cities. And I have a lot of students, current students and former students, who are very concerned because there's this big pressure, I think, when you're leaving law school, just because of how where you take the bar. And it's getting harder and harder, actually, not easier and easier from my perspective, to change jurisdictions for lots of different reasons. How did you negotiate the transition back to Boston, to Massachusetts from DC? And what would you recommend to people who someday might want to make a geographic transition?
Sure. When I took the bar, I took the bar in New York, and I had no expectation whatsoever that I would be returning to Boston. But then my then boyfriend became my then fiance, and he is from Boston and worked in Boston. And so eventually it became clear that I would need to come back so that we would be living in the same city. But I wanted to have kids, and it made sense. But because I hadn't planned on coming back, I hadn't actually taken the Massachusetts bar. Luckily, when I came back, I was nearly 5 years out, so I was able to wave in. But that was potentially a challenge, and it was a challenge when I was job searching because I couldn't say that I was barred in Massachusetts. I had to say I expected I could be within a year, which wasn't ideal.
Is a different answer than I'm barred in Massachusetts.
Absolutely, and especially when you're talking to a small firm, people generally want you to be able to hit the ground running the day you start. Mm-hmm. But I was incredibly lucky when I was trying to come back. I spoke with every lawyer I knew in Boston about what firms were here and what opportunities might be available. And it just happened that when I was looking, my partner, my now partner, Tracy, was leaving Mintz Levin, where she was a big firm partner for 20 or 30 years for her career. And she was leaving there and starting a white collar practice at a small firm and was looking for someone to support her. And it just happened that one serendipitous opportunity was available to me, and I jumped on it immediately. So I would say if you're looking to move cities, you have to look for an opportunity that's open and take what's open to you. You can always change and move later once you get there. It's a lot easier once you're at the new city. Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is unfortunately not that mobile a profession.
Yeah, hopefully someday it will become more mobile as we move to a more mobile everything in every capacity. But I agree with you. I'm not sure it's there. One of the things we were talking about before we started recording was that the partner that you now work with and founded a law firm with was not someone you met when you even were applying for your job. Can you talk a little bit about how that relationship blossomed and if you've learned anything that you will then hopefully do when you have a mentee someday or someone who's less senior than you that you want to bring up in the profession? Can you talk a little bit about that relationship?
Sure. I actually met Tracy for the first time on my first day working for her, which was a little bit terrifying. I had no idea how it would go. Fortunately, it's gone extremely well. I was very conscious in the first 6 months to a year of working with her that I knew her practice was what I wanted to be doing. She was very well regarded in the area and knows the Boston legal market extremely well. And so I knew I really wanted to cultivate her as a mentor. And I was fortunate that she's also takes her role as a mentor very seriously. So she had, in the first year, invited me to start attending conferences for NACDL, which is the National Association of Criminal Defense Lawyers, which she's very involved in. And so I started attending conferences with her, and I would go out of my way at those conferences to try to specifically spend time with her to get to know her. So I remember one of the conferences was in Vegas. She likes to gamble. I like to gamble. I literally just invited myself to join the table she was at one night and spent several hours just talking with her and getting to know her. And that was a very conscious and deliberate choice on my part, which I would highly recommend any associate just getting to know the partner you're working for at a personal level to the extent that you can.
Totally. What I love about that story too is that if someone were hearing it and not familiar with this kind of relationship, it would almost feel like you were doing something as an associate that you shouldn't be doing, or you were targeting or networking or one of those bad words. But actually, at least in my experience, and I'm curious if it's the same in yours, people, more senior lawyers want you to do that. They want to get to know you as a person because it makes it more fun, right? You're spending incredible amounts of time with these people. And so if you can find your points of commonality and actually get to each other's company, that's a plus. But also it's an opportunity to let them do better work. If you can find someone you can trust, that allows you to either get another case or allows you to do a better job on the case you have. And so I guess I'm curious, do you feel like there's any tension there of someone feeling like they're trying too hard, but at the same time, that's what we expect?
Yeah, I don't think the junior lawyer should worry about trying too hard for exactly the reasons you identified. You do spend a ton of time with the people you're working with in a law firm, especially in the high intensity times when you have a trial or some other significant hearing coming up. And you're not going to get through this job if you don't have fun. And the senior people you're working with know that, and they want you to be someone that they can actually have a good time when you see them in the office. And you're also absolutely right that the senior people you're working for want to know you, want to trust you, want to know that your work is reliable because they want to give you more work because it takes it off their plate.
Exactly. It's to their benefit as well. I'm just thinking back as I was a baby lawyer. I had just graduated from law school, and you and another associate who we worked with made it a point to not just get to know me as a lawyer because I was downstream. So you could pass work down. So there was a work benefit to it, but also
we were thrilled to have you.
Yeah, exactly. But you did take a lot of time to get to know me, to get to know my then fiance. I got married that year. And it meant a lot to me, and it made me work a little harder. So I think that was probably a win-win for everybody.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. That was well done on our part.
I love it. So one of the other things that you've done is found a law firm, start a law firm from scratch. And you and your partner are very open about the fact that it's an all women founded law firm as well. Can you talk a little bit about what it was like to found a law firm? Maybe some of the things you wish you had known before you went out to do it?
Sure. Starting our firm was complete insanity. We started it in the middle of a 10-week federal criminal trial in early 2019.
Wow.
Yes. So
well, 2020 got easier, so it's fine. 2020 got easier.
You know,
so
it turns out it actually was downhill from there. It wasn't going to get much more difficult than that. It's a significant challenge, and nothing in law school will teach you about how to run a law firm. Just absolutely nothing. But the good news is running a law firm is actually not that complicated. We're actually pretty straightforward businesses. There are lots of tools and technology out there to make it pretty easy to run a small shop on your own. And there were certainly things that we implemented that we then changed later and we've learned as we've gone. But it turns out it wasn't as difficult as we had feared.
Yeah. And I guess it sounds a little bit like you have your law practice part, but you're also like a small business owner. You're dealing with what's your logo going to look like and how are you going to get the website running and all of those pieces as well.
Yes, absolutely. And some of that stuff we've been able to outsource, but some of it is just not worth outsourcing and we do it in-house. Yeah, I almost feel like I have three jobs. I have my legal job where I'm representing my clients and fighting for them. And that's, you know, obviously the vast majority of my work. But then I have the managing partner job where I'm talking with our accountant and getting our website running and running our social media and all of those things. And then third, there's also my marketing job. Like any lawyer who's getting more senior, you need to be thinking ahead towards business development, and you can never really let that slide. And that is also its own significant workload.
What kind of things do you do in terms of marketing?
So I think in the white collar field, a lot of our referrals come from other attorneys. So I tend to focus marketing on getting to know other white collar lawyers. A lot of our cases, the company might have representation through a bigger firm usually, and then there might be a number of witnesses or executives who are wrapped up in the investigation, and each of those people might have their own counsel. So we're often working in large joint defense groups with other white collar lawyers, and the company's counsel might be referring the witnesses or other executives to other white collar lawyers. So just getting to know the white collar bar itself is a big component of our marketing, and also other lawyers. Most lawyers at some point will know somebody who gets arrested at some point in time. And who do you call when you get arrested and you're trying to hire a lawyer? You call the one lawyer in your life. And that lawyer will then look around and say, oh, wait, I don't do criminal defense, but who do I know who will? So we get a fair amount of referrals that way.
It's so interesting to me because I've talked to people from basically every corner of the profession, from like big firm lawyers to judges to stand-up comics. but to a person, they all talk about exactly what you talk about, which is the best marketing professionally is knowing other people. And that could be knowing other lawyers. That's great. But it also could be knowing the people who live down the hall from you or who live in your community. And it's just, it's amazing to me. That's the thing that I keep hearing over and over again.
Yeah. And it's amazing. And it's true. The more I've been able to expand my network in Boston, the more work I've been able to bring in. There's almost a linear relationship there.
Hmm. That's amazing. So I have a specific student who wrote me an email a couple weeks ago, and she said, I'm at a big law firm and I really want to transition to a boutique litigation firm. And do you have any suggestions? So I don't have any suggestions because that's not something that I know a lot about. But I guess I'm curious what your advice would be to that person, even if it's not going to be today, maybe it'll be in a couple of years, but what should she be looking out for? But also what should she be ready for once she gets there?
Sure. So I think the first question is if there's a specialty area that she wants to focus in and just learning what are the boutiques that are doing good work in that specific specialty. And then try to call up the owner of the firm. Try to ask them for coffee, pick their brains. I've had plenty of those meetings myself. And next time we're hiring, those are probably the people I'm going to be calling first and soliciting resumes from. So just getting to know people would be a really good first start. The other consideration I would say is think about ways at your big firm that you can get experience on your feet or taking ownership of projects, because that's the kind of work that a boutique is going to want to see that you're able to do.
And I think that's really smart advice generally, is build skills and take every opportunity you get. But specifically, if you want to be doing the job, it makes sense that you, what is it like, you're supposed to dress like the job you want, not the, like the job you have. I guess you should be trying to do tasks that are the job you want, not necessarily the job you have.
That's right. Right. And the other just more practical tip is I know a lot of big firms, the associates aren't the ones doing the filing. Mm-hmm. You should figure out the mechanics of filing yourself, because you're going to be doing that yourself at a boutique, and you don't want to be trying to piece it together at 11 p.m. on the filing day.
Yes. It's also why I make my students learn how to do a table of contents automatically, because they're not always going to have someone who can do the table of contents for them. Not that was like a personal thing for me where I'm totally traumatized and I'm now inflicting it upon my students. Totally not the same thing, but just in case. So the other thing you talked a little bit about is you're on this appeals panel. And I don't think people who are not lawyers or certainly not courtroom lawyers even know what a panel is, but also what that process is like and what you get out of it as well.
Sure. So Massachusetts is lucky to have a really wonderful and well-established public defender organization, CBCS. And they have the public defender division, where they have public defender full-time employees who are representing most of the indigent clients that appear. But they can't take every indigent client who goes through the court system, because there's conflicts or because they don't have the staff to do every single case, or for whatever the reason might be. So they also will maintain panels of private attorneys who will accept court-appointed cases for indigent clients. So the appeals panel is, we will take court appointments for indigent clients who have been convicted and are now at the appellate stage. And we will be there appellate counsel, but we will be paid by CBCS.
And what was the benefit from your perspective of getting on the panel and making this a big, or at least a significant part of your practice?
So the benefit is definitely not the money, because the rates are significantly below what we would normally charge. No, to me, the benefit is really just getting the experience. Mm-hmm. It's tough to get criminal appeals. A lot of criminal appeals, by the time someone gets to the appellate stage, they're often looking for counsel that can represent them on an indigent basis. So there just aren't that many privately retained criminal cases out there. And the other benefit is CBCS runs a large amount of really high quality training, and there are moot panels that I can participate in, and I have a mentor on the panel I can call when I have questions or I want to bounce ideas off of somebody. And all of those things are really valuable resources when you're at a small firm and I don't have an in-house CLE program, for example.
No, that makes a ton of sense. And what is your sort of go-to preparation schedule for a criminal appeal? How do you think about it from the second you get the file until you stand up and say, may it please the court? How do you think about your process?
So the first thing I'm going to do is call the trial counsel and find out what issues they think might be available for the appeal, because they know the case better than anyone really. And then quickly try to go visit my client, which you can imagine in the criminal appellate world usually means my client is incarcerated. And so that might, there might be some efforts. I might have to drive some distance to meet with them. But I think it's important that they meet me face to face and can put a face to the named, and that we talk through their strategy in person. And then I'm going to just immerse myself in the file to the extent that I can. I'm going to the courthouse to review the trial exhibits and any subpoena returns that were received, looking through all the pleadings, reading obviously the trial transcript. And then I usually would step back and give it a week or two to marinate if I have the time. And Massachusetts appeals tend to proceed pretty slowly, so I usually do have the time. But just let it marinate and let me think about, obviously I know the issues that the trial counsel has highlighted for me, but is there anything else in there that bothers me that I want to research more? And I'll spend a large amount of time researching and running down sometimes leads that don't go anywhere, sometimes leads that really uncover something that hasn't really been thoroughly litigated yet on the case. And I usually go through all that research and pre-writing process before I ever really start writing at all. And when I finally sit down to write the brief, I usually know exactly what I'm going to be saying. I'm not someone who can just riff in the brief and then come back and edit it later. I really have to know where I'm going once I start.
That's great. What I love about that also, that concept of marinating, and I just think it's a great mental model for any lawyer. What bothers me about this case, right? Like that, if you ask that question every day about every case, you're probably going to be a better lawyer than if you don't ask that question. So that's really thoughtful. And you were talking about, then you start writing, where does the research come in? Are you a research at the front, research at the end, or research all along kind of writer?
Mostly at the front. And then I'll read every case I can find. And that's sort of part of my marinating process. What's out there. But usually as I'm writing, I'll uncover something that when I actually try to write it down, I realize that I don't fully have the point nailed down to the extent that I want to. And so then I'll have to pause and go back and read a bunch more law and do a bunch more research.
Got it. And do you get the opportunity to also argue these cases?
Yes. On the panel, I'm going to be arguing all of those. None of my panel cases have actually hit oral argument yet because Massachusetts appeals are very slow. And one of them, I ended up going back to the trial court and doing some litigation there before going back up to the appeals court. But I did just have my first oral argument in the First Circuit. So for a case that we had tried in federal court here.
That's awesome. How'd that go?
It was a great experience getting ready for it. And our co-counsel on that case are some of the best lawyers that I've ever worked with. There were a lot of great people to bounce ideas off of and to work through with as we worked together on our briefs as well.
Any big surprises having just had your sort of first appeal after having done so much trial court work?
I wouldn't say there were any surprises, except at the end of the day, your argument is so short. And you spend so much time getting ready for it. If I looked at the pile of notes and cases and just other documents that I read through getting ready for the oral argument, it would dwarf anything that we were actually able to get out during the course of the oral argument.
Yeah, but right at the same time, if you hadn't done it, you wouldn't have been ready. So that's the tension. So I want to ask you about the only job you have that I imagine has less pay and worse hours, but is more rewarding, and that's being a mom. As a dad myself, I love talking to people who have young children and asking them what, if anything, they've figured out. I hate the word work-life balance because I still haven't figured out what the balance is, but how they find fulfillment as both a parent and a lawyer.
Yeah, I hate the term work-life balance too, because there's definitely no balance about it. I think especially at a busy stage in your career when you also have young children. But I have just loved seeing my daughter learn about what I do. And she will say, Mama is going to work to help get the clients out of jail. And I just, it makes me so happy every time she says that. I'm training her well, but just seeing her grow and learn and have her watch me and know that she can also grow up and do what she wants as well as be a mom is incredibly important and fulfilling to me. And it's also just critically important that we set aside time to spend specifically with her. And sometimes that's 7 a.m. when I have a little bit of time before I have to come into work. Sometimes that's Sunday afternoon. Sometimes it's bath time at night. But we're able to carve out those times around everyone's schedule.
I'm picturing her saying that to you and your husband. That's amazing. And obviously, one of the last things I like to ask people about is to go back to their first job in the law. And you were lucky enough to clerk for a judge on the Southern District of New York. And I'm just wondering what, if anything, 10 plus years out, you feel like you learned from that experience or gained from that experience, especially for people who are considering doing a clerkship?
Sure. My clerkship was really the first time I seriously considered doing criminal defense because I had so much exposure to what criminal defense lawyers do on a day-to-day basis because in a trial court criminal case on a daily basis. So that was definitely a lesson that I took home with me and has obviously paid off for me over time. But I think anyone who has the opportunity to clerk should do so because it is the best opportunity you will have to gain insight into what the decision maker is thinking when you submit a brief, what arguments are effective, which ones are possibly less than effective, what tone is appreciated, how you can be useful to the court or to the court's clerk, which is in turn going to be useful for your client.
Yeah, that makes so much sense. And I think that's true, at least in my experience, because I totally agree. If you can get a job, even interning for a judge or sitting in on a judge for a day, it doesn't really matter what court, like being part of that judge's brain for any period of the time will make you a better lawyer. And the more time you can do it, the better lawyer it'll make you. So I think I totally agree with you. That makes a ton of sense. Look, the last question I ask everybody is if there's one piece of advice, and you've given a lot of it, so I'm not so worried about this, but one piece of advice that you either received and really appreciated or that you like to give to young lawyers, especially people who might someday look in the mirror and say, you know, what Megan does sounds a lot like what I think I might want to do. What's that advice?
Sure. When I was in law school, someone told us that someday somebody was going to knock on our door and give us an opportunity that we couldn't necessarily predict, but that was going to be something completely new and amazing and that we would want to take. And that until that day arrives, we should live our lives so that the answer is yes. Keep your budget down, pay down your student loans as soon as you can if you're in big law, and keep developing new skills, keep networking so that those opportunities are coming in the door. And then when it does come, say yes.
Again, that was Megan Siddle, managing partner at the white collar boutique Minor Siddle, based in Boston, Massachusetts. I'm so grateful to Megan for discussing her practice, her experience in different legal environments, what it was like to found her own law firm, and how she handles cases big and small. If you enjoyed this episode, you can find past episodes at howilawyer.com or wherever you get your podcasts. I can be reached at howilawyer@gmail.com or @JonahPerlin on Twitter. Thanks again to Megan. Thanks for listening, and have a great week.